If we spoke a bit about a public theology this morning, we're going to kind of look at where that gets played out on the ground, so to speak, in real life. And so we're going to take a look at what I've described as the theme of faithful citizenship. I will put a little caveat before we go on. Bishop Larry mentioned, I think, Doug Hall's book this morning, and Tillich. I like Tillich. One of the things about Paul Tillich, who was a very important theologian in the last century, that he did, and I think there's something that's instructive for us here, is Tillich, in terms of writing a systematic theology, rewrote a language first, then wrote the systematics. And I think we as people of faith need to be careful about language. In fact, we need to come up with new language. Not to say that the language we speak, the religious language we use, the terms we use, isn't important. It's near and dear to my heart, believe me. But my experience, having done 25 years in sort of political corridors and government places and all those kinds of NGO gatherings, is using a different language that unpacks those theological concepts in a language that's more popularized in a way is very important in the current climate. Because oftentimes the religious language we use is the code, and we speak the code. Two dangers with that. One is we think we know what the other person means, right? So when I tell you and get up here and say, I've sinned, I guarantee if I stood up in a pulpit and said, I've sinned, most people wouldn't think I cheated on my taxes. Right? Using this language, people attribute meanings to it that is not always what you intend. And so we need to be careful. Secondly, the difficulty with using the religious code is often that it shuts down the conversation. There's a lot of people who've been hurt by religious communities or have prejudicial views or assumptions about religious communities. And if you use a certain kind of language, boom, it precludes a serious engagement, at least in the public arena. Now, having said that, the very interesting thing for me is the Canadian political scene is one thing, but I did spend a fair bit of time at the United Nations in New York and in Geneva. And in that venue, it's remarkable about the openness to talking about things theological, religious, spiritual, however you want to construct those. And so there is a very eagerness to engage people, but using language, it's important. So be attentive to that. Which is partly where I'm going with this presentation, is trying to give you some tools by which to unpack your engagement with both political leaders and others in the broader public. So we're going to launch off on what I'm calling faithful citizenship. The things we're going to do in this presentation, I'm going to talk about the new versus the old geography of the public commons. How many of you have heard about, you all know about church state, right? Raise your hand, just lunch, post-lunch, just a little exercise. We often frame these issues between the church-state issues. I would argue, and for Lutherans, it's Luther's two realms, right? And I think this kind of modality doesn't work well for us in the current reality. So we're going to talk about that and what advocacy 2.0 is, in my sense. Second thing we're going to talk about is Canadian church contributions to the common good. This is the dispatches piece. I will include some of this here. Martin, this is kind of what we were talking about just before. We were chatting about why religious leaders aren't, you know, perceived so much as having influence anymore on some of these issues. And I think this is an area where I'll flag a few things. I won't say a lot of this, but actually this is what I'm speaking about at King's tomorrow, I think, as well. The third thing we're going to do is how do we do faithful citizenship? And this is what we talk about in terms of advocacy often, and I'll say something about that. And lastly, as a fourth element of this, I'll talk about what politicians expect of people of faith. One of the studies that got me, as some of you know, I was doing public policy work that Don Schoberg knows pretty well because he was one of the people I had to report to about it all and kept a good eye on me, and also was very effective as a religious leader. You two might want to have a conversation about some of the interventions that when Don was the national bishop, the LCIC took on for our church and had an impact about. But one of the things I got involved with is when I started doing my doctoral work, I said to myself, you know, I wonder, we often, many people in the church articulate why the church should be involved in social justice, human rights, all those kind of things. By the way, going back this morning, that was the political theology presentation or point. But we never, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to ask politicians what they think? So we did a study where we asked politicians whether or not they thought churches, particularly, should be involved in politics, and if so, how? And we got some very interesting results. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that, the different expectations, and that's where this comes from. Okay. So the new geography. We often hear of church and state. When we say church and state, we often mean the church and the government. Or another binary kind of formulation is public and private. When I say public, what do you think of? What's that associated for with you? Some words. When I say the public, what do you think? Public sector, public what?
Government.
Government. What else?
Schools.
Corporate, the collective, common good, sure. We often think, though, in these kind of terms that are much more political in terms of, like, government, public institutions. When I say private, what do you think of?
Oil companies.
Oil companies, yeah. We're in Alberta. Private. Any other ideas?
Individuals,
sure. Families. But this formulation isn't really helpful, this public-private today, because it's incomplete. It's probably true. There are private private aspects of our lives, private aspects of society. But what I've tried to articulate here are, I don't know if this thing works, are, there it is the idea of the public commons. And this is a little different than maybe what some of you what many people characterize this public-private discussion in the media. The public commons is that space that is shared by, we have economic actors, and who might these economic actors be? Their business, their corporations, their labor unions, their regulatory bodies, their oversight bodies, international financial institutions, and all those kinds of things. These are the economic actors, and the principal responsibility of this sector is the generation of wealth. And wealth means something very specific. It's not just anything, it's something that's durable and leads to improving human well-being. That's the responsibility of the economic sector, economic actors. Then there's the government actors, and here we're talking about many organizations, parliament, legislatures, ministers, government organizations and institutions. There's a whole plethora of them, and they provide sort of order. I mean, they look at governance. The form is governance, right? Providing order. Then we also have churches, faith groups, and some people would link these two together, but I don't, because I think that faith groups and churches are distinct in the sense that they have a continuity over time. Tradition is important to them. They're linked to a past. They have also a transcendent kind of quality to them that makes them different than other civil society organizations. But this is what we might call the religious sector. And what's the religious sector? The governing form here is one of meaning. Right? There's a sense in which these are the things that ultimately determine who we are and what's important to us and what we want to invest our lives in. And the last is what I would call civil society organizations. This is known as the third sector, the voluntary sector, whatever. By the way, the voluntary sector isn't mean that people don't get paid. The economic impact of this we'll talk about in a minute, but I'm not just talking about volunteerism. I'm talking about all the plethora of organizations that do have an economic impact as well, and I'll mention something about that a bit in a while, but it is important to recognize that civil society organizations are important. Here, the governing principle here is competition, the governing principle here is collaboration, the governing form here is meaning and purpose, and the governing form here is order. Maintaining security and order. Okay, go ahead. When we talk about In most places in the world, we talk about social ministry, social justice, that kind of thing is the language we use a lot in Canada here. In other parts of the world, they talk about prophetic or diaconia, and in fact, diaconia involves a number of things. I just want to talk a little bit about this so that you understand a bit of the landscape here. If the goal is social change, advocacy is certainly one part of that, and we'll talk a little bit about what advocacy looks like. Advocacy is powerful speaking for the powerless, addressing institutional structures. It's about reform versus revolution. Okay, is one thing. The decisions are often made by leaders in organizations, so it's not inconsequential. We were talking about the role of religious leaders, for example, or the role of governing boards within church or faith institutions, or the role of foundation board. There's a leadership role component. The other, working for social change, one of the other ways is through community organizing. This is a very important way we need to learn a lot more about Canada. By the way, there's a group, I think the Roman Catholic Diocese here has done a lot of work around community organizing, if I'm not mistaken. But this is an area we need to think and explore more among the religious community. But it's the powerless speaking for themselves through organizing. It's one-on-one visits. In other words, identifying people that share your passion. And it's also about leadership development. And if you want to look at some examples of this, Google community organizing on the internet. There's groups like PICO, the Industrial Labor Industrial Association in Pennsylvania, I think it's called, and some of these organizations, and they have some interesting clips about how you do community organizing. But the goal here is social change. When we talk about, there is also another important goal. And by the way, again, I'm not saying this one is more important than that one. I'm just saying they're different. But social stability is important. And here we have another part of the diakony, or the role we play, is in fact through charity. And that, you collect food for the food bank. I won't ask you how many churches do that, but that's a natural thing. Churches generally collect a lot of food for food banks. And some people have always lamented, I know in my previous life, some people say, well, it's not justice. Charity's not enough, right? And it isn't enough. But we need to remember, it's often the first step on the road to justice. One of my friends who was a pastor in a congregation, she always had the food drive, right? And they took the food down to the first year they collected the food and sent it off. And then the second year they collected the food and they drove it down. And the third year they collected the food, drove it down, and packed it. And then the fourth year, they also helped hand it out. By the fourth year, these people were committed to kind of working for justice and addressing welfare reform and homelessness issues and all of that. Charity is the first step on the way to justice. And it deals with immediate needs. That's the important thing to remember about charity. It's not a long-term solution. But, when people show up, they need help now. They don't just need help. They don't need you can't talk to them about structural injustice and all these kind of things and wait for 20 years to rectify it, right? I mean, this is not the kind of a message that's hope-filled. The other part here is solidarity. Humanity and creation are interdependent. Here it calls for people to overcome race, gender, and ethnicity, nationality, or economic position. Solidarity is, something I often say is, no one is anyone without everyone else. That's what solidarity is about. Right? So the point here is that my humanity is tied up in your humanity. We all bear the image of God. That means, something very important, that there's a fundamental connection right from the very beginning. So this is a little bit of the geography. We're going to talk a lot more about advocacy, but I want you to keep these other aspects in mind, because maybe we need to think about those too in terms of how a public theology of belonging gets played out as well. I think it does in these other examples as well, but I will speak a little bit more about advocacy. Okay. So politics is the art of the possible. Bismarck said this, it was a very somewhat cynical view of politics. So when we talk about advocacy, what we're really talking about, from my perspective, is preserving the public commons. This area, this shared area, and it's, it might be called a virtual thing, although I think it's very real in some respects, is the space where we generate creatively. It should be a place of some ferment and some dynamic interaction and transformation. And it's a cauldron, a bubbling cauldron that creates a sense of the public purpose, the common good. It's generated out of that. It's just like, it's like fermenting for good beer or great wine, right? I mean, this is, you get something that's very, something desirable at the end. That's the public commons is where that's generated. You'll note that this is a little different than saying that, we were chatting about political theology. Often in a political theology, you want the government to, in fact, implement something that's in pursuit of the common good. In this kind of scenario, the common good emerges, governments need to make sure it happens, and needs to safeguard that it takes place, but they don't necessarily have to do it all. You know, and I think this is a really an important distinction here when we talk about the role of the public commons and public theology. It's all of our responsibilities to make sure that this happens. Again, it's what we owe each other in a sense. So advocacy is about making what is necessary possible, in my view. And what is necessary is, if you think about the hierarchy of human needs, there are some things that take precedence over other things. You know, that we, you know, the needs for food, clothing, a place to live, a sense of purpose in your life. These are priorities over and against the wants or the desires, right? And so advocacy is making sure that those things stay central to the public purpose. So why is it so scant? Let me give you an example. Why is unemployment so scandalous? It's scandalous in a number of reasons. One is, people need to make a livelihood, right? They need to make a living. So there should be a priority on employment and labor or work over the priority of capital. This is, by the way, at the heart of, not just Catholic social teaching, but it's at the heart of all the other churches as well. The second reason why employment or work is a priority is because work is the means by which, through our vocation, not our jobs, our life's work, is the way we contribute to the economic well-being of our neighbor. And if we deprive people of the opportunity to work, it's not that we're just depriving them from the ability to earn a living for themselves and their family, we're depriving them of an ability to contribute to the well-being of their neighbor. And that is a theological perspective on work, which is not shared within the realm of most economic thinking, shall we say. So this is about what's making necessary possible, making what is necessary possible. And that means there's some priorities we have about what should be on the advocacy. Advocacy also is about preserving the public commons to serve the common good. In other words, we need to be very careful about what happens to this space. And one of the kind of criticism I often level at governments, including Mr. Harper, including Mr. Martin's government, including some of the governments in Ontario and other provinces, has been that they've been a bit cavalier with this space. They don't see it as important. So when they don't, when governments actually weaken the civil society organizations that participate here or undermine the role of faith groups in this, this is not a good thing. They tend not to undermine the role of, by the way, the economic actors, but in a way they do. I mean, when you underline the role of labor organizations in this country, you're weakening the ability of the public commons to function. Now, don't misunderstand me here. All of these sectors should be under some scrutiny and should be critiqued for what they contribute to that. I said somewhere that if churches aren't contributing to the public good, we could ask a question then, so why should we enjoy the benefits of, you know, tax-free status or things like this? We, in fact, have a responsibility, and that's why we enjoy some of these privileges. So we need to critique these things. This is my point. We need to be careful that we make sure that this is safeguarded and is allowed to be creative. And, for example, the labor movement is important. When we weaken the role of unions in a society, there's a price for that. Now, that's not to say unions don't make unreasonable demands or do things that we don't approve of. Sure they do. We need to critique them. We have, by the way, over the years as well. There's a healthy dialogue between all these different groups in different ways. But my point is that the purpose of all of that is not to just be mean and nasty or, you know, be a pushover on the other side, but it is to make sure that we preserve this public space for clearly articulating the common good. Now, and also note here, no one of these has a monopoly on what that is. And this is a danger with churches particularly. We get pretty self-righteous about what we think is best for society. And I don't need to tell you about looking at some religious organizations, some Christian, quote-unquote, organization in this country that aren't hesitant to say, thus saith the Lord, this is the common good, and this is the only way it looks like, which denies a role for all these other sectors as well. So advocacy, one of the important things, is about preserving the public commons as a place to articulate, nurture, strengthen, and implement the common good. When we talk about the role of faith groups, I think there are really two. By the way, this is a picture of the Lutheran World Federation Assembly in 2003, a vigil to protest the Indian delegates to that meeting. You've heard of the World Council of Churches. Some of you are Lutheran, know about the Lutheran World Federation. This was a vigil that was held to protest the fact that the Canadian government at the time denied visas to the Indian delegation, and there were issues about that. One of the funny stories about that was it was a Liberal government, actually, and one of the lead delegates, his name is Chandran, and get this, Paul Martin. I said, why did you put Chandran in it, Chandran? I said, you should leave that off. If you said you were Paul Martin, you would have had no problem. They probably would have sent a jet for you. But we often think of the role of churches as being sort of being prophetic, being out there on the ramparts. It's a lot more complicated than we have. Yes, the prophetic role, challenging government policies and the directions in economic and social sector. We have there's a responsibility to do that, to critique them, protest, all those things. But there's also a pastoral role, that is, to affirm the vocation of government, namely, particularly politicians, and business and the voluntary sector. And hear me when I say I'm very critical of governments, an equal opportunity critic here, but I am very affirming of many politicians. These people make huge sacrifices to do what they do, and we don't know. We just don't know the price that their families pay and they pay. Now, there's some bad apples in the crowd. Don't misunderstand me, but there are bad apples in the church crowd too, believe me that. I think some of you know that better than I do. But the reality of the matter is we need to affirm this as an honorable vocation, or we're going to get politicians we don't want. And I think this is very important. You know, one of the things I do, I regularly have breakfast with quite a number of people from, even today, politicians in various parties, and we sit down and chat and we talk about all sorts of things. We in the faith communities need to hold those folks up. I mentioned I won't tell the whole story, but how many of our churches, for example, invite folks, politicians, to come in and meet with our council? Or how often do we take our church councils? Or do we have? The story I'll tell is make a long story short. I took a cab ride. I had to interview Bill Blakey out in Transcona, and those of you who know Winnipeg, Transcona is a little ways out there. So I got a cab one Saturday morning. I had an appointment to interview him. It was part of the study we did I was telling you about earlier. And we're riding out to Transcona. I'm realizing this is a long way out. And I said to the cab driver, I said, how do I get back, from here? Is there a bus or do I get a cab? Oh, the cab driver says, there's no coming back from Transcona. I mean, so I'm thinking, okay, where is this, the end of the world, right? And he says, when are you going to be finished? I says, an hour and a half, 2 hours. He says, I'll come get you, he says. So I come out of the meeting with Bill Blakey, and right there's my cab. I couldn't believe it. It was like having your own driver. I felt like a cabinet minister or senator or something. And so I get in the car, and so he starts talking to me. He says, what were you doing with Bill Blakey? I said, I told him about the study we're doing. We're interviewing people, blah, blah, blah. And he says, very interesting. Bill Blakey's a very, very good man. He says, he comes to our temple once a year. He comes out and spends the morning with us. And he says, he's Sikh, right? He didn't have a turban or anything, he says he's very active in his temple. And he says he comes out and he talks to us, answers all our questions, tells us what's going on. And he usually spends 2 or 3 hours with us, and we have some food, and it's a really good event. He's a very good man. And I thought to myself, you know, how many churches invite their local member of parliament or their MLA or their mayor or somebody to come and be at their events or meet with them or talk with them? I teach a course in church and society, or did. It's our new curriculum has phased that out. But one of the things I tell the students in that class, the first people you should visit when you go into your parish, you should go around and meet the MP, the MLA, or the MPP, the mayor. Go and meet these people and ask them what's going on in their community. They have a ministry in a way. We see them larger than life in the meetings and the press conferences and all this stuff. But they, in fact, are trying to respond to people's needs, and they give you a window on the community we need to see. And we as church people and as religious people should be doing much more on that. I think this is important. So this is about the pastoral role. We also have the prophetic role. And I think we need to keep those both things in balance to some extent. Okay. When we talk about advocacy, I like this quote from Alexander Hamilton, those who stand for nothing fall for anything, right? There's a certain sense in which we see the campaigns up here. This is the bit above the waterline. But below the waterline is all this stuff. And we need to do our work to understand that. We need to study the issues. We need to read. One of the things I was great... I can say this, I suppose, is that we've had great debates about human sexuality issues and about inclusion of gay and lesbian people in the ELCIC. One of the profoundly disappointing things for me is how little people read about that issue. Now, I think there's arguments to be made for and against. I'm not going to get into that debate. But what struck me in many of the debates we had is how little people read about anything. And in fact, they didn't do their homework. It was all about their feelings. And I'm great on feelings. I think feelings matter, sort of. But you got to do the rest of the work, which is to support that. I teach a course also in theological method. It's called Spiritual Reflections and Critical Theological Thinking. And I always tell this is a graduate course. I've told the students, look, I'm not interested in your opinion. I'm not interested in your opinion unless you can show me the evidence from other sectors, other fields of study, the evidence from the tradition, who else in your tradition is saying this, and you have experiences that you can analyze and back it up. Otherwise, your opinion, Plato was always, in terms of the Republic, he often warned about the rule of the mob, you know, because they were governed by their emotive opinions, right? This was his big concern. We need to, in fact, do our homework. We need to do all of these kinds of things. And by the way, we need to pray regularly and try to open ourselves up to God's presence to help provoke us in our thinking. We need to make space in this kind of pursuit for that kind of reflection as well. And one thing I would say very strongly about all of this stuff in terms of advocacy is the last thing. Showing up matters. Oftentimes I go to things and I say, what the heck am I doing here? What's a nice guy like me doing in a place like this? You know, I mean, you kind of wonder, like, or you're saying, I'm just too tired to go. I don't have time for this. I got other things I'm going to be about. And I'm not clear what I'm supposed to do when I'm there. Actually, those have been the moments when I've been surprised. Surprised by what I've seen, learned, discovered, or the connections I've made. People. So don't underestimate serendipity here and the work of the Spirit to surprise us when we show up for things. Turning up, and somebody was saying this morning about getting out. I forget who was that. He said, we got to get out of the church, or get out of our churches more, go out more. This is important. Very important. Okay. What I want to underscore here is that when we talk about the public commons, and Frederick Buechner, who's a Christian writer, has a great definition of ministry. It's where your deepest passion meets the world's greatest need. Okay? It's an interesting intersection, isn't it? So when we talk about how it is we put our public theology into play and into practice, how we articulate the common good within this public commons, we need to bring to that encounter passion, and we need to recognize what the world needs most. These are two things that are very important. And so these issues, this is where we begin to start to address them. So let's go on. So let's talk a little bit. This goes to your point, Martin, just now. What happens when the when we talk about the principalities and powers? But when the powers fail, a great book by trilogy of books by Walter Wink. Some of you know he's got a short version out of it now too. But it's naming the powers, engaging the powers, kind of thing. But what happens when, in fact, the economic sector dominates the public commons? We end up, in fact, part of what I'll talk about on Saturday around Sandel's work is that, in fact, the market has colonized the public commons. It has taken a commanding control over this space. So you run into these ways in which people talk about what the public purpose ought to be is strictly in a very narrow range of economic terms and objectives. All right? So one of the things, the national interest is served by negotiating free trade agreements. This is one limitation today. We don't say a lot about other aspects. It's also, by the way, one way of doing economics. It's a liberal approach, not political party liberal, but a liberal approach letting markets decide what the social priorities and the common good should be. Francis Fukuyama, some of you have heard of a book he wrote called The End of History, said that liberal democracy and free markets, in liberal democracy and free markets, humanity has reached the zenith of its development. We've reached the pinnacle of development. This is the highest form of social. Now, mind you, he was there for all of about a nanosecond having this claim because everybody kind of piled in on him. But this notion that somehow liberal democracy and free markets are, in fact, the pinnacle of human social organization, it's just not true. By the way, liberal democracy and free markets are not necessarily complementary. They may be adversarial in many ways and mitigate against each other's development. So you can have free markets or you can have liberal democracy, but you might not be able to have both. And there's a bunch of people starting to write on this theme and look at it. But what we're talking about here is when the market colonizes the public commons. And globalization, Benjamin Barber, Jihad and McWorld, I think it was the book he wrote, has a great line. He talked about the problem of globalization is globalization makes private what should be public and makes public that which more appropriately should be private. And what he's talking, for example, you do not own in this kind of model your own DNA. In fact, it can be used in terms of genetic and biological research, and it's not necessarily, in a sense, yours to possess, which is something that should be private. Think about pornography, right? Pornography is, my friend of mine tells me, the only way to make money on the internet is through pornography, right? All the other stuff isn't making money. And if you look at what Facebook now today, the news says teenagers are dropping out, their participation rate in Facebook is falling, ad revenues have gone up. But a friend of mine said, the only way to make money on the internet is through pornography, right? What does pornography do? Pornography is about taking something that should be private and making it public, right? It illustrates this kind of thing. Likewise, in sort of some of the economic things, we take things like water, which is public, and we make it private, right? And where I live, Nestle has come in and has bought a bunch of farms and drilled wells and sells bottled water. And as if this is a legitimate commercial activity, right? Water is a kind of public good. So, in a sense, we're taking something that's public, making it private. Economic globalization failed because it came to dominate all decisions and tried to determine everything. If you want an example of this, go to Argentina. I was in Argentina for a month on a little mini sabbatical thing. I was at the theological school. There's a debt there, and they gave me a fellow. I was trying to learn some Spanish, which was pretty much a hopeless enterprise, but we had a great cross-cultural experience, and so we went on, visited all these different kind of communities, and I experienced a good bit of Argentina. We're driving down the road one day, and Gerard says to me, he says, well, they privatized this road. There's a toll booth coming up. And I said, wow, that's pretty interesting. And I said, well, what did they do? Did they build the road? No, they didn't build the road. I said, well, what did they do? They don't maintain the road either. And he said, what did they do? He says, well, they privatized it. They built the toll booth. That's privatization, right? You have to put money in a public road. I mean, the road was built by the government, built by the taxpayers ostensibly, but privatization. Argentina was a master case study in how to impose globalization on a whole country and impoverish a whole nation. And in fact, all the sort of traditional approaches to economic globalization went awry in Argentina. But it's one of the few places when you go into a church, right? There's a woman, 80 years old, Hungarian ancestry. She does really well on the goulash thing. She knows how to make and cook and all this stuff. They have a great conversation. And then she's talking to you over the goulash about debt equity swaps and the International Monetary Fund. People in Argentina know about these things, right? Because this has been a whole place where globalization has failed. But the image here is when the powers fail, one of the ways it can fail is when the economic actors dominate the public commons, which is, I think, what you were alluding to before, Martin. Okay. So part of the role, if we talk about getting advocacy being restoring the place of the public commons, you need to push back, right? You need to push corporations, business, economic actors to assume their rightful role. And in a sense, if you want to just go back a minute, the idea is, can we go back a minute? This needs to be pushed back so it's back up here and we preserve that space. How did that happen?
Right.
Is the churches have done a number of things. One is Canada, in 1988, opposed the free trade agreement with the United States, and also NAFTA. I mentioned, the churches, their human rights work in Mexico. For example, 2 months before NAFTA came into effect, the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America, which I was part of and many of your churches supported, warned that there would be violence in the southern part of Mexico once the free trade agreement NAFTA came into effect. Why? Because the United States would dump all sorts of corn, surplus corn, on that market. Eventually, it became mixed with genetically modified corn, which was a problem for many of the indigenous farmers in the region. And in fact, it drove the price down, drove many of those farmers out of business. And on January 1st, when NAFTA came into effect in 1994, what happened? Do you remember? The Zapatistas, right, launched their war in the southern part of Mexico. One of the other issues was the debt cancellation campaign, illegitimate debt. How many of you were involved in that? This is a little small poll. Did you sign the petition? Well, there's about 50 people. 1 in 50 Canadians signed that petition. 650,000 people across the country. Paul Martin said that initiative alone by the churches put the international debt issue on the agenda of the G8. You were involved in some of this too, I think, Don, I recall. This was a hugely important thing, pushback. The ISARC social audit from 1976 to 1977, one of the things that was put forward there was the idea that, I said that when you look on the news, the national, they have these things, the Canadian dollar, the TSX, they have all these little measures. Why don't we have things that measure about how well we're doing on poverty or how well we're doing on homelessness? We don't have any metrics about those. And in fact, our argument to the provincial government in Ontario, and the Liberals adopted this as a policy, never implemented under Dalton McGuinney, but agreed that they would conduct a social audit to say, okay, these are our policies we put in place. X number of years later, we will look and see how they did. Did they reduce poverty? Did they reduce homelessness? How many new affordable housing units were created? So forth and so on. Conduct an audit, just like we do on a financial budget, to look at the social audit. So these were areas to help push back and allow the public commons to be preserved. Okay, go again. When the principalities fail, here we're talking about what we traditionally refer to as totalitarianism. Here the government actors dominate the public commons, right? These are command and control societies. I mentioned earlier this morning about East Germany and the government there. We love to pick on the communism. It's certainly a form of command and control. Failed because it doesn't provide incentive. There's all reasons it doesn't fail. But the interesting thing about being in the eastern zone of Germany is there is a bit of grief over the fact that some of the security that people enjoy for basic necessities has gone. I mean, they don't want to go back there. This is true. I don't want to over-romanticize this. But there is a sense in which they have been a little shocked by all of a sudden being wide open to the kind of market approach. And by the way, which is not as wide open as North American markets are, is that it takes place in the western part of Germany, western Germany, when the wall came down. But there are other forms of command and control societies we've seen in other parts of the Middle East, in other words, where governments take an inordinately dominant role in the public commons. And in some sense, if one were to characterize the Tea Party people, well, this would be the thing they would be greatly fearful of, that the government would do it all. Now, mind you, I think they're misguided on a whole lot of other things, and I don't want to sort of give them some creeps. But this is, in a sense, a pushback to say, and when I was introduced, we talked about restoring the vocation of government. When governments overreach themselves like they do here, we need to kind of push them back so that they accept their proper place and their role of providing order and assuring that certain things happen. And this is a fundamentally different point. I want to just highlight this a little bit more. That what we're, you know, often, you know, when I'm down in the States and I run into some of my Republican friends who are, who say, well, certainly you don't want the government to do it. No, I don't want the government to do it necessarily. But I want to make sure that certain things are done and the government ensures that they happen. Right? So you look at our healthcare system in Canada, the government doesn't deliver healthcare. It's not a socialist system of healthcare, is it? It's a social insurance system of assuring us that health care will be delivered. By who? By the not-for-profit sector, right? Many of these hospitals, they're religious hospitals, they're volunteer, they're community hospitals, they're not-for-profit organizations. The government ensures that between these two, and in some sense between with churches too in some cases, who own some of these hospitals, that service is delivered. And that's a different way of thinking about it, and one that I think gets lost in some of the debate, especially by conservatives who argue that, you know, well, we don't want government to do this. We've got big government. Likewise, it's lost among some of the Liberal Party, political party people as well. Urban Kotler, for example, was talking about chaplains, you know, and how you might have still heard in the news that chaplains were, part-time chaplains were being cut back, and this disproportionately affected non-Christian faith groups and so forth and so on. And so the question was, should we have any chaplains at all in public institutions? Bear in mind, the role of the chaplain is not first and foremost to provide spiritual services. The role of a government employee employed as a chaplain, or an employee from here, is to ensure that they are provided. In other words, they safeguard the religious freedom of all people, not just Christians, not just the community from whom they come. They need to be trained. They need to be proficient. They need to deliver some initial professional services. But if you've been in a hospital lately, you know, the chaplain may come, and you may talk to a chaplain, but their principal job is to make sure they connect you with your community. And if you don't have a community, to do some temporary remedial things to get you over the hump, to find out who you do need to connect with. It's a different view. Irvin Kotler missed this point in his remarks to the CBC. I thought it was kind of unfortunate. But again, it's an example of not the government doing it, but ensuring that it's done. And chaplains, even though they're government employees, are this reflects a partnership between these two sectors. Okay, let's go. The other one I want to mention here is when the principalities... So when, how have the churches pushed back to get government to what we would say restore the vocation of government, which is to provide order and ensure these things are done? Some of the things, one, in the patriation of the Constitution, the Section 35 I mentioned, did I mention that here? That the churches were responsible, we were talking about it. That's right, sorry, I know I was talking about it somewhere. You know, there's a great story about Pastor Enquist in Lake Wobegon, and the Olli Tollefson faction of the church just wished that, didn't like Pastor Enquist very much, but they just wished he'd bang on the pulpit once so he knew he wasn't talking in his sleep, you know. So I'm a little worried about that today. But anyway, so regarding Section 35. Section 35 is in the Canadian Constitution. Why? Because the churches fought to get it there at a time when nobody else was lining up with the AFN or anybody else to support the entrenchment of Aboriginal rights in the Constitution. People liked the idea, but nobody And this, a huge credit goes here to the Anglican Church of Canada, to Ted Scott, who led this initiative, to the Catholic bishops and other churches, and I think you might have been around when that was going on as well. All the churches, and to bear in mind that the First Nations organizations, you know, the Inuit, the Métis National Council, the AFN, others, who didn't always see eye to eye, didn't always recognize each other's rights in this process, were brought together by churches to argue to get it entrenched. The tragedy was that they were never articulated and fleshed out, as was promised by the government to do through a number of constitutional conferences. But, again, this was a pushback. Lotteries, casino gambling, I love these issues. Churches, this is not the appropriate role for government. Why is casino gambling so abhorrent? Because in casino gambling, and by the way, and for the sake of full disclosure, I said this somewhere else the other day. You know, my father-in-law used to love to play poker. I don't like poker as a rule, but I won a lot of money off the guy because, I mean, as a son-in-law, you don't say, well, no, I ain't going to play poker with your father-in-law. It's not the way to ingratiate yourself in a new family relationship. So I'm not a purist on these things, but what's so wrong about casinos, state-sponsored gambling, is that the government is the beneficiary, it's the regulator, it's the manager, and it's prepared to victimize at least 4 to 5% of the population who do have problems with gambling. And bear in mind, the next generation, that number jumps to 10 to 15% in terms of problem gambling. The government is prepared to victimize these people. Why? So the rest of us don't have to pay more taxes, right? Because you can't raise taxes. God help us if we raise taxes. Heaven is going to fall, right? So the reality of the matter is pushing governments back, opposing the expansion of casino gambling, it was a way of helping restore government, pushing back to preserve the public commons. Sunday shopping, same thing. One of the things about Sunday shopping was important was the fact that churches never argued against Sunday shopping because we thought it was going to keep people out of church. That wasn't the issue at all. In most jurisdictions where they opposed it, it was because it was going to take away a common day of pause when families and friends and neighbors could get together and the civil society, the social organization of society, could be nurtured and maintained. Now, what do we have? We have a market that runs 365 days a year, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. There's a relentless barrage of buying, selling, your consumer society, where people, as I said this morning, are no longer taxpayers, or no longer citizens and neighbors, they're taxpayers and consumers. So Sunday shopping was about capital punishment is another one. There's no capital punishment isn't in this country for one reason alone, and that's because when it was tried to be reinstated, churches opposed it. At the initial part of that debate, 80% of the people were in favor of reinstating capital punishment, and by the end of the debate, 20% were in favor of it. And the reason was that through a massive educational campaign, it was shown, and is still the case, that executing people, the state using its power to execute people, does not make for safer streets. In fact, it makes in some ways for streets that are not safer. And the three strikes, you're out rules, laws, and all these things in the states that were opposed have been demonstrated to be utter failures to create greater public safety. So churches were involved. This was part of the pushback. We can go ahead. Also, the case, this was Namibia, the war on terror, some of the dirty wars in Latin America. When there was no information about what was going on in Central America about the human rights abuses, it was churches who provided much of the documentation and information. The Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America did a huge amount of work in this area and brought to the public consciousness a lot of the violations that were being perpetrated against very innocent people. I mentioned the Second Gulf War as well. One of the things there was that there were four, did I say the story about the 4,000 petitions a week going into the Prime Minister's office? Nod your head or something. Have you heard this before? Through Project Plowshares, this was the ad that was in the Globe and Mail here, this was run. 4,000 signatures a week went into the PMO's office. Chrétien basically opposed the war in Iraq and told one of our bishops, Bishop Michael Price, that that in fact he said this was a major factor in why he was able to oppose Canada's involvement in the Iraq War. The Second Iraq War, which, by the way, was an illegitimate war because it did not have UN sanction. George Bush Sr., when he had the first Iraq War, complied fully with the UN mandate in this regard, whether you agree with the war or not. At least it did have the appropriate authorization through the United Nations. George Bush Jr. Was in fact did not have such a case. So these were ways in which on peace and security issues churches push back. Let's go to the next one. Theocracy is another area. This is when faith groups dominate. We've seen theocratic regimes in various parts of the world. One that comes to mind is Iran currently. These are not quite that simple, but we need to be careful that we don't just point to the fingers elsewhere. We have those who want to create a kind of theocratic impulse in our own society. Think about the Tea Party movement, for example, in the United States. Think about Christian Zionism today. Think about some of the other organizations, religious nationalist organization that Marcy McDonald speaks about in terms of Canada. There are theocratic impulses everywhere, and we as church people and people of faith need to be careful to challenge our colleagues. This may be, as even we're talking about places where we disagree, but I'm not saying with you, but I mean where disagreements between faith groups, we need to hold each other to account about these things. And say, wait a minute, this is not the kind of Canada we want to create. And so we need to link hands with people across faith groups and say, wait a minute, this is an appropriate way for religious communities to function in this society. This is not. And clearly we see examples of outrageous behavior by some more conservative religious groups in Canada, which should be alarming. But the objective here is to push back the faith groups to assume an appropriate role. Let's go to the next one. Civil society, I want to mention, we've not seen a situation where civil society has tended to dominate the public commons, but it's playing an increasingly active role in the public commons. If you look at some of the numbers, in 1946, there were 441 NGOs in consultative status with the UN. 92, there were 700. 2012, there were 3,400. At the beginning of the 1900s, there were roughly three international NGOs. Now, I'm not taking into account mission societies here for those in churches. There were a lot of mission societies. But there were roughly three NGOs. Today, there's probably 80,000 NGOs. In Canada, there's at least 106, this is a little old, this is figure is about a year and a half, 2 years old. At least 161,000 registered charities in Canada. They have $112 billion in revenues, and they have 2 million employees. This is an economic force. Now, when I say this to some groups, especially people who are kind of more from the business community, they say, well, yeah, but who pays for all of that, right? I mean, the reality is, you know, it's donations. That's true. And we treat it as if the economic sector supports the wealth generated in the economic sector supports civil society. And to a large measure, that's true. But understand that economics has changed today. We live in an information society where information has a value attached to it now, where, in fact, we're not merely into wealth that is things you can touch and feel and smell. It's information, it's services, it's all of these things. And civil society is going to be a major factor, a major actor in this. One of the things I also say is that if we look where the new jobs are going to come from for the future, they are not going to come from the private sector. People, they're just not going to create the kind of work that we need to create for young people. Where are they going to come? They're going to come over in civil society. And people are going to get paid. This is, again, not volunteerism. This is people who are going to work. And when you think about young people, you know, they want to do things that matter, right? One of the largest programs at the university I am at is service learning programs, where people go out and work in the community, work in organizations, and get credit for that as part of their training. One of the areas we're exploring at our school is, can we do something around multi-faith community organizing as a venture? We've got to figure out how to pay for it, how to get the academic program in place, so that people can be equipped to go out and create livelihoods in this sector, in a sense, their life's work. Some of the things churches have done to underscore and support the social sector have been some of these things. I won't say a lot about them. I've talked about a number of these elsewhere, but let's go on to the next one. This table right here. Who's one of you, yeah?
In the days of Lahi, and that's an ancient story. But there was a lot of unemployment. And so the labor unions and the churches, they got together and they established some unemployment centers.
Mm-hmm.
We had one in Edmonton,
mm-hmm.
and I became the whatever you can call it, the person who approaches all the churches,
yeah.
and have the meetings with them, how they could help their families who are unemployed and facing difficulties. And so we had a center and office and everything, and I went to all the churches, starting from the Catholic Church to a United Church, all the churches, the Lutheran Church, the bishops and all, and told them the story that how they could help those families to be not alienated from their own groups of faith,
mm-hmm.
because they were unemployed and they were ashamed to let people know. And many people, congregation, they even paid their utility bills, mm-hmm. or groceries.
Mm-hmm.
They will, and so in this way they could help their own families.
Right.
And then we had established this food bank. And so those people who will come, we will give them the vegetable, the fresh food, mm-hmm. and other. Christmas time, I carved the turkey.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who are unemployed, they could come and eat free for 3-4 hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people came.
Huh.
So I felt that the churches and the people as a whole, they were involved in that problem of unemployment. And I counseled them how to approach the various government agencies for help.
Yeah, good.
And one time, we were on TV, but I never went on TV. The Edmonton General came to me to have, you know, some interview with me. I refused that because I said, you can say a minister of the church. So that was all.
Yeah.
And so even though I didn't want to be named, but I felt that it was all right to do all those things for the sake of our Christian faith. You know.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Who
you are. Yeah, good for you. Good for you. Memorable moment. Great. Now, did we miss? There's some. Did we do your table? Did you guys give us a memorable moment over here? No.
You're asking me or?
No, anybody from the table. Did you have a member? Did we ask? I didn't want to overlook anybody.
Just working with the homeless.
Yeah. Was powerful for you? Okay. Well, think about these memorable moments. Think about these kind of activities, what they do for you, how you feel about them, how you talk about them, right? They're the stories that matter to us, you know, when we recall things. So let's move on. One of the things then, we have two challenges, and I would argue in terms of our role. One is the perception of our church members or faith group members. And the other is the public perception and what politicians think of us or think of our contribution. And this is where we're going to go to the last part of this presentation, where I said, you know, we talk about what the expectations are of people of faith. But this actually comes from, I think, a cover of a church magazine. Is your church a politics-free zone? I run into all sorts of people who say, you know, the church shouldn't be involved in politics. Church shouldn't be involved. What does the church know about these things, you know? What does the church have to contribute to these things? I mean, it's quite remarkable. Any of you bump into sort of attitudes like that? Yeah? I mean, and even among in the academic, I work with a group of, attend a group of Lutheran ethicists gatherings, and there are a couple more conservative folks there who say, well, the churches don't have any expertise. Let me assure you one thing. The churches have some of the most renowned expertise in these fields. You mentioned Project Plowshares. Ernie Regeer received the Order of Canada for his work. He was the director for a number of years. He's in high demand by a whole range of people. The Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America, I mentioned, it was for years the leading organization that documented in a very professional way. The flagrant, gross, and systematic violations of human rights in El Salvador, Guatemala, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Colombia, all of these places, they were one of the most reliable sources of information for governments in determining their posture. So it's just patently false to suggest the churches don't have. We have one of the most extensive networks and some of the most brightest legal, analytical and minds going. In fact, in some of the economic policy, we have some of the foremost thinkers in this field as well. So we have the expertise. But going to the second question is, should the church be involved? Let's talk a little bit about that. So can we go ahead? I skipped this one. We'll go to the next one. Essentially, what I'm laying out here are, I ask politicians, okay, so do you think the churches should, and I ask churches, sorry for those from other faith traditions, the question was, do you think the churches, namely our church, should be involved in politics? And the answer among all the parties, the only party that wasn't included, I should be honest, is the Bloc Québécois and the Parti Québécois, which we didn't have anybody participate for a variety of reasons in that. Mainly it was to try and get there and get access and all those things. So it wasn't that they didn't want to, it's just that we couldn't pull it off. But we had people from Reform, Conservatives, Social, New Democrats, Liberals, I think one Green Party person, provincial level, federal level, and they all unanimously, to a person, said, yes, the church should be involved in politics. Now, when I say politics, that's a short form. I'm not talking about endorsing candidates or particular party platforms or any of that, but in the public, the public part of the political process. And in fact, one of the Reform fellow an answer I'll never forget, which he said, you know, if the churches are going to enjoy religious freedom, they have a responsibility to make this political system that assures that freedom work. It's kind of an important reminder to all of us. We just can't be existing in these communities, and as I said, enjoying some of the benefits we have without, fulfilling our responsibilities. This is an important part of faith, what I call faithful citizenship. So what I did based on the results of that study, and there were a whole lot. There's actually some interesting things. One was the one thing we said, well, what would be, for those of you who are clergy, you might enjoy this. So what was the one thing that you think the churches could do more of? One of the things that came up was in terms of preaching. They all identified preaching as an important activity, but preaching of a certain variety. You know, that the one fellow said, and I remember this quote, he said, you know, and he goes to all sorts of churches, you know, he visits around. He said, I've heard more sermons that are three Bible verses surrounded by a cute story than I've heard thoughtful, provocative reflections on an urgent and imminent question facing our society. Very interesting. And so I had a research assistant, and so the research assistant was a fairly bright fellow. So he said, well, okay, so do you remember a sermon? You know, do you remember any of these sermons? And they all remembered a sermon. It was very interesting to me. They all remembered a sermon they didn't agree with. Right? I mean, that they were opposed to. And it was very interesting, because if you'd asked pastors that question, and they said, yeah, we think preaching, and yeah, we, you know, think, do you remember a sermon? They'd probably pick a sermon they agreed with, right? The difference between an ecclesiastical culture or a church culture and a political culture, because in politics, until the current iteration of it, unfortunately, dissent, disagreement, is the lifeblood of politics, debate. Engagement, going back and forth. In fact, I would argue it's the lifeblood of church moral deliberation, too. We do want healthy tension, healthy interaction, healthy debate. And if anything, in most of the debates I've observed in recent times, have been somewhat a little light in that regard. But it was very interesting to me that politicians saw it as an issue they didn't agree with. Well, anyway. So it led me to, in analyzing all the results of this stuff, and in subsequent years, as I've talked to politicians, asked them some anecdotally the same kind of question. I came up with a bit of a typography which I want to share with you, which helps lay out. And it's important when you're doing advocacy with politicians to understand where they're coming from, okay? And crafting your argument. You can't speak to liberals like you speak to conservatives, like you speak to social democrats, even on the same issue. So this is partly what this helps with. Well, let's start with the first group. And by the way, when I mention these titles, these are not linked to political parties. So when I say liberal, I'm not meaning a liberal party necessarily. That's a bad example, but are conservatives, do I mean conservative party? I'm talking about a conservative orientation, okay? So, but let's look at the first. So when you're talking to conservatives, they look to the church to be, what's that? Yeah, I know, but they're not meant to be that way. The only trouble is I am not, listen, you're talking to someone who in grade 5 passed potato art on the promise to his grade 5 teacher he would never do anything artistic again. And Tim, you've just identified one of the reasons why, with the colors and things like that. But it's not meant to be exactly that way. Now, there are some parallels we'll make, but it's not exact in that sense.
As we got your subtlety.
Yeah. Thank you. But in terms of conservatives, and by the way, part of my argument today with my conservative, with elected representatives I meet with and talk with about who are conservatives, members of the Conservative Party, is they're not real conservatives today. This is the problem. We need conservatives. They don't conserve anything, conservatives, right? This is a big problem if you're a conservative. And this is one of my issues with them. But for conservatives, they look to churches and faith groups to be the kind of moral custodians, right? They're the people who advise the powers, right? The typical approach to advocacy in this kind of vein is to whisper in the king's ear and say, this is what I tell you to do. This is good advice. Do this. This is the right thing to do. Right? There's a kind of morality that underscores this. And so, you know, you pick an issue. If you're talking about, well, let's take an issue. On casino gambling, for example, in the province of Ontario, we talked to conservative members of the provincial parliament, they got the moral argument, you know, victimizing your neighbor, blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. That was where they were at. The casino gambling thing is also bad economics, right? So when you're talking to liberals about it, you got to. I'll point that out in a second. It's a little different argument, but for conservatives, it was the moral argument. It was that this is immoral because it victimizes your neighbors, right? For liberals, for liberal-minded people, by the way, many of the conservatives like Stephen Harper and some of the conservatives in Ontario and elsewhere are much more in this quadrant than they are in this quadrant. And by that I mean they believe in kind of liberating markets, more open kind of economic activity is the driving force in society, right? And that society needs to facilitate progress. As I say, we've got to always get things better, right? Liberals, the traditional approach to change things is through education. If you educate people, you know, you make social progress that way, right? This is the part of the argument. For liberals, they're looking for individuals with good ideas. So when you show up in the offices of some people who have the liberal orientation, this included people even to some extent like Mike Harris, you make the case not around morality. You know, you make the case it's a good idea. So like on welfare reform, for example, with conservatives, you'd argue, look, we owe these people. These are people who are dependent. They require some support. They need a hand from us. This is important. With liberals, you make the argument, no, this is an investment. This is lost productivity with these people. They're not working. They can't get jobs. They can't get back into the workforce. It's a different argument. Their kind of approach is looking for the good idea. And so when you're doing advocacy there, you're talking about how do you put forward a good idea. The social audit I mentioned earlier with ISAR was a good idea to Mr. McGuinty, right? He liked the idea. He didn't necessarily buy the reason why you do it from an ethical or moral point of view. He bought the idea because he thought, oh, man, this may be a good idea and would play well in terms of some of his choices. For social democrats, it's about solidarity. It's about showing up for the demo, as I often say. But it's also about making the connections between communities and people. The more people you can bring into the room, the better off you are. So one of the things we did at Queen's Park Once upon a time, I'm trying to remember, we did actually a couple times around welfare reform. We had a vigil on the lawn of Queen's Park leading up to the provincial budget, right? And we had all sorts of church leaders and religious leaders coming in, union leaders and other people showing up. And the NDP loved that. Because it was a big tent, right? There's a lot of different people. There were community groups, community organizations, women's organizations, big tent, right? Bringing lots of people together. For communitarians, the idea is building a sustainable community. Oftentimes, this perspective is associated with sort of the Green Party to some extent, although not exclusively. A lot of Aboriginal organizations very much reflect this view. I often wondered, and maybe you have too, is that how some of the first, like Brazeau, the senator, right, an Aboriginal person who was appointed as a conservative senator, I cannot understand how an Aboriginal person might support some of the Conservative Party policies on First Nations, right? How would you reconcile it? Well, in some ways, there's some similarities between each of these. There's a closeness. Likewise, with, you remember, we used to call them red Tories, progressive conservatives. You have a few here in Alberta, too, I think, is, as I understand. Well, there are some connections here. One I often know, a couple of the progressive conservative candidates actually ran in other ridings later in life for the other party, for the New Democratic Party, for example. So what I guess I'm trying to show you is that there are different expectations that have, and these relate to, if you look at change being the kind of principal agenda, you're going to move this way. If you're looking at progress, you're going to kind of move this way as the kind of governing objective. If you're looking at community building, you're probably going to go this way, right, to some extent. And if you want to look at maintaining the continuity and the tradition of a society, you're kind of probably going to go this way, right, in some respects. It's about not just about change, it's about continuity. Some of the group up here was talking about tradition and that this morning, about belonging and hanging on to something. Remember when we were talking about that? I mean, there is a role for continuity. You want to, tradition is important. So what you end up with is understanding that there are different expectations. Yes, all the political perspectives think churches should be involved in the political process, but there are a variety of different expectations about what that contribution is. And if you're going to work with political parties or in the political process, more broadly speaking, you need to understand, at least this is one way, there may be other ways you can, what the expectations are of what you're going to bring to the table. And yes, I you know, in some ways, these aren't necessarily coincidental with the existing political parties, but they do, you know, there's some implications to recognize who these folks are. One of the key things that we learned in Ontario was that, in fact, with the Mike Harris government, was that they weren't here. They were actually more up here. And so when you started to pitch your interventions around welfare and housing and things like that, you had to make them more around social progress arguments than around moral obligation arguments. And because the moral obligation arguments went nowhere with Mike Harris. You know, that government just didn't buy into that at all. So this is, and by the way, I'm saying this without necessarily judgment. I mean, I do make judgments, but as I said, I think that there are different moments, each of these perspectives plays an important role. Sometimes you want progress. Sometimes you want solidarity. Sometimes you want community building as the principal objective or outcome. Then you need to, you know, raise that up. And in fact, when we, through elections, we do see some of this. Let's go to the next one. This is a bit of, also, if you're doing kind of advocacy stuff, you need to understand the political life cycle of a, now this is of a government, I'm going to say more about advocacy, but this is political advocacy. All governments go through a life cycle, right? You start out, there's the winds of change, new possibilities, you know all the standard lines that politicians come up with that. They eventually form a government, they get to implement their agenda, you know, and they're starting to roll it out. There's a few glitches, bumps in here and there, and maybe some false starts, but generally they get going. Then they reach a certain stride and a kind of political confidence they have. They exude this in the media, in the press conferences. There's a lot of kind of strength comes out. Oftentimes they manage their agenda very well. They got three or four major big policy things they're working on, and ministers and the backbenches all stay on message and stay on side and go for, you know, realizing that They and then if they reach this point, if they're at the this is the great time for a re-election when they're at the top of their game, right? They maybe accomplished two or three of their objectives in terms of their platform. They're still kind of going to then go to election and hopefully get back here and start up the ladder again. Generally, most governments don't do that. Most governments keep going until they make some mistakes and there's some crises, right? You know, missteps, miscues, ministers, you know, get off message, something happens, a scandal, you know, they try to cancel gas plants for hydro generation and it goes wrong, or they have a false start with e-health, as it was the case in Ontario, or they got three senators that go AWOL on them, you know, kind of thing. These are all kind of mistakes. They get into some political games to try and figure out how to get back. They do some damage control, they sometimes call it management. By the way, these are the way other organizations do this as well. And then you get what I call the corruption agenda, the corrupted agenda. I don't mean illegality here or criminality, although it may mean that. There are instances when there is that unfortunately happens in some cases. What I mean by corrupted agenda is like you ever have a software package that gets corrupted on you, right? And no matter what you do, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do anymore. You can punch in everything and yell and scream at the computer, pitch it out the window. It ain't fixable, right? You got to get a reboot and a restart and a new program. And this is what I mean by corruption. And eventually you end up in political defeat and in the political wilderness. And then there's this wailing and gnashing of teeth and all those kinds of political exercises that go on, and political rebuilding, mergers, reunions, and then you end up over here, and we go through this again. Now, this isn't a perfect cycle, but it's meant to illustrate some of the stages governments are in. By the way, I would suspect that we're somewhere around here currently on the federal scene, and so we shouldn't be surprised by all of this stuff, right? This is the way it works, and as much as people protest to the contrary, this is what you end up. Let's go to the next one. But what I want to talk about at the end as we wind this up is that when we talk about the public commons, it's about public choices involving many publics in the public commons. That's what we're trying to do. When I talk about public, I'm using a very specific definition here. Unlike public-private, like we talked about at the very beginning, publics are voluntary associations that bring people together around an idea and who are transformed in the process. The CBC program Ideas has got a thing on the nature of publics. This was the definition they used. We in the churches need to understand the role of these publics. I would argue that ministry today for clergy, for anyone, is about identifying your publics and speaking a life-giving gospel word, life-enhancing word, to those publics and addressing them where they are. And there are multiple publics out there. You with me on this? So when we talk about public, it's not some generic no-name big group of whatever. There are many of them, and many of them assembled in such a way, combined to form the wider public. And our job in the public commons is recognizing there are many publics. Now, this was a graphic, or the cover, off a cover of a report that was done that identified all the players in a public policy decision. So you have a past decision. It comes into the public policy making process, and all these different groups you have here all play a role. So here's the cabinet, and here's the cabinet committees, and then here's the House of Commons. Now this is just on the political process, right? And then you have all these other groups, departments, agencies, academic communities. You have a whole range of people who all play a role in this. And when we speak of the public commons, it's not a neat, tidy little affair. It's messy. And it's confusing. And what we need to keep our eye on is, how do we kind of identify these publics, and how do we contribute to the public commons, safeguarding the public commons, in gathering around some common ideas, and as a result, we're transformed in the process. Remember those memorable moments we talked about a few minutes ago? Those are little transformations for all of us. Life-changing things. Why do we remember them? If you think of those memorable moments, we often can visualize where we were and what happened when they took place, right? These are transformative, and that's the kind of thing we're talking about. One more. I think this is the last one. You need to build some alliances. These are some resources, and let's go to the next one. As I just said, if we look at the various publics, we get almost, I often said that this is the election map of 2011. You can see, even in this case, there are a whole range of different kind of publics that we have out there, as illustrated by how people voted. You could do it by churches, you could do it by professions, all those kinds of things as well. We can go to the next keep going the other way. That's it. And lastly, this is where it is. If we think that this is going to be easy, think of poor Moses dealing with the people of Israel. And they didn't want to. You know, remember, there were more people who stayed in Egypt, the flesh pots of Egypt, than took the Exodus challenge, right? More people stayed home than went. And so it will be complicated, it will be confusing, and it will be messy. But it'll be worth it, because that's what we came for. You know, to make some changes, to help life come to people who are in desperate need of hearing a life-giving, life-flourishing word. So with that, I'll say thank you, and maybe if there's some quick questions, we can conclude with that. But thank you very much.